The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Okay, so when Kirk and McCoy are on the shuttle, and they're about to head up to orbit, and McCoy says that if there's a hull breach, the blood would boil within 12 seconds. And you say on your blog that that's wrong. Can you explain?
McCoy does in fact say that, but it is wrong. And I got people arguing with me saying, well, your blood will boil. This is interesting. The temperature at which something boils depends on the material itself, like, you know, water versus blood, and also how much pressure there is. At lower pressures, water, for example, will boil at a lower temperature. I live in Boulder, Colorado, which is at 1,700 meters, about 5,200 feet a mile, and water here boils at a lower enough temperature because of the lower air pressure that we have to adapt our cooking to account for that. It's much harder to cook rice here than it was when I lived at sea level in California. Right. So you have to account for that. So at zero atmospheric pressure, water will actually boil at room temperature. Water will turn from a liquid into a gas. Well, blood, it's not so easy with blood. Your circulatory system is airtight. And so if you were to go out into space, you won't get that boiling blood myth that everybody talks about. Your blood's not going to boil. But I argue, some people say, well, if I go down into the ocean and come up too quickly, then I'll get nitrogen bubbles in my blood. And that's the same thing. And I say, no, it's not. Because what you're doing there is that you have gases that are already gas dissolved in your blood. And when you change the pressure that rapidly from high to low pressure, the gases won't stay dissolved in the blood. They form into gas, they form pressure, and it hurts you. It gives you the bends. But that's not boiling. You're just removing gases from the blood. It's actually just condensing them, sort of. Right. So it's not really boiling. It's different. When people say your blood's going to boil, it's not going to boil in the first place because it's an airtight system. But even if it could, it's not the bends. That's two different things. If you open up a bottle of Coke, right, and it fizzes up, that's not boiling. That's just the gases that are dissolved in it coming out. That's all it is. It's a different thing. And there's a billion other myths about going up into space. You'll freeze instantly like Tim Robbins did in Mission to Mars, which was an atrocious movie. But you don't freeze instantly. As a matter of fact, you would freeze eventually, but it would take a long time for your body to lose the heat radiating away into space.
Okay. I know that we have an email question and we have someone waiting on Skype, but I get one more Star Trek question. So Kirk, Sulu, and the red shirt, they jump onto the shuttle, onto the mining drill. And so the ship was still in orbit, and they jumped out, but they didn't burn up. Explain.
Well, you know what? I had this discussion with somebody from TrekMovie.com. We were talking about this because I was writing my review for my blog, and they were going to post it as well. And it occurred to me that the ships are not in orbit. The drill that's being lowered from the Romulan ship is probably tens or maybe even hundreds of miles long. But the only way it can be over the same spot on the surface of the planet, there are only two ways to do this. One is to be in a geosynchronous orbit. In other words, to be in an orbit that naturally takes the ship as long to go around the Earth as the Earth orbits once. So that's a 24-hour orbital period, and that turns out as about 40,000 kilometers up, about 24,000 miles. They are clearly not that high up off the planet. They're only a few hundred miles off the planet. So they must be hovering. And if they're hovering, they're not in orbit. So when they jump out, they're just free-falling down to the drill. Now, they're going to be booking. They're going to be moving really quickly. And so as they do that, you do see that they're rushing through the atmosphere. I don't remember, did they actually get hot? I don't remember. But I don't think they were moving hot enough to burn up. They would just feel some heat. But as it was, you know, they pulled their chutes and were able to stop. That scene was actually a lot more accurate than people give it credit for.
Huh. And thank you for putting so much thought into this.
Well, I thought it was pretty interesting because, you know, I was getting in this discussion, and I was going to write, well, they're in orbit. And so when you jump from a ship in orbit, you're not going to fall. You're going to stay in orbit. And that's when I realized, oh, they're not in orbit. They're hovering. So when they jump, they will, in fact, free fall and fall down toward the planet. Okay. Just like jumping off, you know, a building.
Star Trek gets a pass. Brilliant.
Bring it on. The skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, because we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking's retrospective episode. I'm your host, Desiree Shell. And I have other people in the booth with me today. The entire Skeptically Speaking team, actually. So introduce yourselves, guys.
Hi, I'm Michael. I'm the electronic communications expert, as well as another title that I forget.
You have no idea.
I do.
All right.
Hi, I'm K.O. Myers. I mostly do the editing to make the rebroadcast version sound even better than the live version.
Hi, I'm Lisa Skovnik. I am the studio technician in training, so I'm essentially for mic.
I'm Ryan. I'm the soundboard operative.
Operative? I don't think that's what it says on the website. So today we'll be stepping into the Wayback Machine, and we'll be playing as many clips as we possibly can from the last year and a bit of Skeptically Speaking. And it's also the last time this year that we get to ask for your donations to Fund Drive. And that's the annual fundraising campaign of our benevolent host station, CJSR. So the clip you just heard at the top of the show was from Phil Plait, the Bad Astronomy episode. And I was obviously very, very excited. So, is anyone else excited about Star Trek? Or is this just me in this booth? Seriously,
I am
people.
Always excited about Star Trek.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Really, that's it? Awesome.
Yeah, always.
Okay. So when is it okay to throw cold water on somebody else's excitement? Skepticality's Derek Colanduno explains.
I watch horror movies a lot, so there are tons of examples of non-skeptical, really fun movies. So do we have to be the person in the theater saying things like, you realize, given the speed and trajectory, the craft wouldn't turn that way, because that's potentially really annoying. Although Phil Plait did that after Star Trek. And that was awesome. That was a great post. But do we have to be those people?
Well, it's kind of funny. You mentioned Phil Plait. I think he has like the best tact to it of all. He even said in that post where he tore apart the new Star Trek, he said, you know, it doesn't matter because he enjoyed the movie. And I think that's the big part. And sometimes we do have to be the person that says, well, that really wouldn't happen. Because that's how the myths happen that people believe. And Skepticality at the beginning, that was our show. We talked about things that people thought were real.
Exactly.
Because of pop culture.
Mm-hmm.
And corrected them. You know, things like, you know, if somebody fires a gun in an airplane, it blows up or, you know, sucks everybody out. It doesn't happen. Or when there's a car crash on a movie, it doesn't matter what's going on. It blows up like a bomb. And it's like, think that about that for like 1 second. Then every rush hour, it'd be like the war in Iraq.
Right.
So when things happen all the time that people believe, you should correct that. But you don't have to like be, you know, the downbrow that makes everybody go, well, you made this not fun.
I frequently am that person.
I actually frequently am. I'm always actually that person.
You're not the only one.
We all are, I think, in this room.
People don't find that annoying. They find it endearing.
Really?
Yeah, no. I do that on every single date, and it never goes wrong.
So what do you think? Is being skeptical synonymous with being a party pooper?
No.
I don't think it has to be. Just I think it depends on how you do it. I think the point you made about Phil, he does it in an amusing way. If you can be funny, you can get away with a lot more harshness, I think, as long as you can be amusing.
Well, does it read your audience?
Very good point. And does it depend on what party you're pooping, exactly? Really?
Well, poop is always contextual.
Okay, now we're digressing. Let's talk about donating.
Actually, let's talk about the fact that there is a difference, because some mistaken beliefs are more harmful than others. So let's listen to a clip from Scott Gavura's Ask a Pharmacist episode. Go ahead, caller.
Oh, hi. Hello. I've just been listening and hearing some of the comments made about homeopathic medicine, that it doesn't really work. We only have ever used homeopathic medicine, and some of it is very, very wonderful medicine. Natives use it as well. They're quite well acquainted with natural medicine. They find that it works. Many cultures around the world find success with natural homeopathic medicines. So I think it has a lot to do with the diet you may be on, whether or not it works within the body. We're vegetarians. We don't have a problem with natural medicines. But from my understanding, if people on a non-vegetarian diet may experience not being able to absorb natural homeopathic medicine.
How would you respond, Scott?
Well, I just have a question for the caller. I'm not sure if I understand what you're speaking about. Are you talking about homeopathy, or are you talking about natural medicines? Because I don't consider...
I'm talking about both, and I'm including also Ayurvedic. I don't know if you've ever heard of that.
Yeah.
They
yeah,
are all quite functional and very useful They all work, but it depends what your body is made up of, how they act on the body. For example, if you're taking tons of calcium and your body is sick to begin with, you're wasting your money and your energy because the calcium won't be absorbed by the body. So it's a science.
Okay.
It's not just some kind of fortune-telling thing, homeopathic medicine. It's a science.
Well, thanks very much, caller. Now, while Scott answers, we're going to get somebody else on the line.
There are also hundreds of books on the market about homeopathic medicine.
Interesting thing when we look at homeopathy is that it's been studied in a lot of clinical trials, and what we find is the better the quality of the trial in terms of the rigor of the trial, the quality of the design, that it's placebo-controlled, that it's double-blind, there really isn't any good evidence to demonstrate that homeopathy works any better than a comparable placebo. And that's exactly what we would expect, given that there's no active ingredient in homeopathy. So I don't doubt that your caller's getting better, and that certainly is the case. I mean, you can look at the placebo effects with some, even in drug trials that are looking at prescription drugs, and you can have a placebo response of 30 to 40%. In some cases, it's absolutely remarkable what the placebo effect can do. In the case of homeopathy, I mean, there's no active ingredients. There's no reason to expect there to be any physiologic response because there's no medicinal ingredient. Now, if we're looking at herbals, then there's absolutely medicinal ingredients in there, and there's absolutely biochemical effects that can be measured. And I think from a pharmacy perspective, that's certainly the most interesting part of the natural medicines is the natural medicines, the herbal remedies themselves.
So that clip really brings up a very important point about the way CJSR operates, which is that we are a public radio station. We work for the public, we speak to the public, the public listen to us, and the public call us on these funny phone telephone things. And that's really an essential part of the process, and I'd like to invite everyone to help us build that shared public environment in which learning and science are valued by donating to CJSR.
That was beautiful.
Thank you.
Honestly. what Mike was also saying is that Skeptically Speaking does outreach. We air on 22 radio stations, and the majority of the people who are flipping around on the dial are not, well, probably not, possibly not, terribly scientifically inclined. So we want to be able to continue to answer people's questions, especially the ones that affect their health, like that woman's question. And you can help us do that, our lovely audience, by donating. And here's Aaron Santos, author of How Many Licks, with some potentially life-saving advice.
Okay, well, here's one with that I thought of myself,
okay,
which has lots of information. So if the Skeptically Speaking team got locked in the on-air booth, which used to be a bank vault,
yep,
and we'll assume that it's airtight when the door is closed,
mm-hmm,
how long would it take for us to run out of air? And so we have five people in the booth every show,
mm-hmm,
and the booth is about 10 feet by 6 feet.
And I'm going to assume that you have about a 10-foot ceiling. So you can calculate the volume of the room. And if you remember your high school chemistry, you can use the density of the air and the molecular weight of, let's say, nitrogen to calculate roughly how many molecules you have in the air. And from that, you can calculate the, or rather, you can look up the fraction of oxygen molecules, which I assume is what you're talking about, because you're not technically going to run out of air. The air will still be there. It'll just have much less oxygen in it.
Right.
But you can calculate the number of oxygen molecules that you have. And then it turns out that this is another one of those things that you can feel free to look up. But each time you breathe in oxygen, you lose about 25% of it. 25% of it gets converted to carbon dioxide. So you have your total amount of oxygen that you need to lose. So then it's just a question of figuring out, well, how much oxygen do I lose per second? Well, you have five people in there, so that's five times as much as one person, obviously. And each person's lungs have about 5,000 centimeters cubed of volume in total that they're sucking in air with. And if you're using all that volume, and let's say you're taking breaths once every 3 seconds, you can calculate how quickly you're using up that oxygen. So you just have to divide up the total amount of oxygen that you have to do by the rate at which you're sucking up that oxygen. And if you do that, and assuming my math is correct, I got you guys living for about 2.5 hours.
Oh, that's it?
Yeah, so not very
wow.
long at all. So don't make any sudden movements. Don't jump up and down. Just sit there and barely breathe.
I would like to point out that since this was a bank vault, you sort of get a bit of vacuum pressure sometimes, and sometimes people get stuck inside it, so we don't close the studio door all the way. So if there are any other programmers, CGSR programmers listening, you have 2.5 hours. You're welcome.
This is the first time I've ever been in this booth, and if this ceiling is 10 feet tall, then I must be about 8.5 feet tall.
This is about 10 feet tall.
I don't think it's anywhere near 10 feet tall. And I'd also like to point out that I love all of you, but I would stab you all to death first.
Well,
I would hoard all the air.
I was actually thinking that 2.5 hours is not enough time to revert to cannibalism. Mike?
I don't know. I don't think there's really a timeline for these kind of things. I mean, you're all looking tremendously more attractive already.
And it's, you know, we actually have 6 people in the booth this evening, so the time would be far less than the 2 hours.
Who would you eat first? No, I'm serious.
Mark Ryan. I'd go after Ryan first.
Mark Julian. Because we'd
French.
Only have to... Maybe this is not appropriate conversation.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. You can email your questions for next week's episode to live@skepticallyspeaking.com, or if you're on Twitter, we're at Skeptical Radio, or use our handy question submission box on the website at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also subscribe to the show in iTunes or listen to past episodes, and while you're there, why not add your review? Skeptically Speaking is rebroadcast on a number of fine radio stations. Check the media page at skepticallyspeaking.com to see if we air near you. And now, back to the show.
On this show, we also take quite a few close looks at urban legends. And you know the one about the Great Pacific Garbage Patch? The one that says it's so huge that you can actually walk across it in places, that it can be seen from space? That urban legend? Miriam Goldstein was part of a science expedition that went there, and she set us straight. You know, this is a very popular show, Miriam. I'm not asking any of my questions because I actually... we're receiving a lot of emails here. Next email question.
Climate change has polar bears. Are there any species that the Great Pacific Garbage Patch can claim as its specific victims?
I think that albatross tend to be the poster critter for the Great Pacific Garbage Patch. And that's because albatross are true oceanic birds. They're wonderful birds. They have a 10-foot wingspan. They're huge. And they can lock their wings so they can actually fly for days without flapping. And so they spend months and months and months out at sea. They're definitely one of the most charismatic animals that are out there in the gyre. People have called it an oceanic desert, and that's true. It's not very productive. Which there's not, it's not like the coastal ecosystem with just teeming with lots and lots of big fish, or used to be anyway. Out of the gyre, it's very nutrient poor, so it's hard for the little plants to grow, and then you don't get a lot of big fish. But like a desert, the animals that live out there are very specialized and cool and used to living in a place where it's hard to make a living. So, I mean, I think there should be like poster jellyfish and like poster sea snails and things like that. But
I would buy that poster. So this, to me, is actually one of the best reasons to be skeptical. Because, yes, it turns out that the garbage patch is nothing like what we hear. It's not massive piles of trash in the middle of the ocean, but that doesn't mean that it's not an environmental issue. It's still a serious problem. And the danger of media presenting exaggerated information is when people hear that it was wrong, they assume the entire story was wrong.
And I mean, the visual impact of, you know, there's gigantic piles of trash out there. I mean, I could see someone in a well-meaning way taking that and trying to, you know, expose the problem. But then when it turns out that that's not the case, I think it's harder to make the case for the fact that there is a real environmental danger going on there, even though it's not so, you know, vivid.
Well, I guess the little particulate bits are really about the size of coins, which is... You know, it's very dangerous for animals. Obviously, it gets into the food supply, and it's an extremely serious problem. But yeah, it doesn't make the visual presentation that we all have in our minds when we think of the problem.
But that's the thing. Science isn't black and white, so I don't understand why these issues would be black and white.
And it also kind of points out the value of, like, going there to check. You know, how many of us are, you know, we go on the internet and we read about it and we say, oh, wow, there's this pile of, you know, there's this island of garbage in the Pacific. Miriam and her crew, they actually went out there to look. And, you know, that, I think that firsthand reporting is kind of valuable and something we maybe we should be encouraging more of.
I agree, but I do remember that episode, and I think she said they were paying like $40,000 a day or something like that for an expedition. So we don't all have the ability to go do something like that. But definitely, we here at Skeptically Speaking try to provide the best information available, and that's so you can make reasonable decisions about what to really be worried about. So part of that is doing our bit for consumer protection. And here's Paula Bagan on the Cosmetics Cop episode. Are there any substances that consumers would be surprised to find included in their makeup?
I think the silliest one that shows up repeatedly is probably oxygen. Oxygen is 20% of the environment. You go much over 20% oxygen, and it's actually deadly. Hyperbaric boost, you can stay in for a small amount of time, and then it actually starts causing damage. It's not good for you. So often these cosmetic companies, to lead you to believe they're giving oxygen to the skin, use an ingredient called hydrogen peroxide, just like the stuff you buy at the drugstore in a brown bottle. Hydrogen peroxide, one of the ways they judge free radical damage is the formation of hydrogen peroxide. It's a potent free radical. It's one of the ways they determine what's damaging skin, and that's what they're sticking in your skincare product. Now, not many companies do that, but a lot of the spa lines that say they're giving you fresh air, one is that it's not a very stable ingredient in skincare products, but nonetheless, it shouldn't be in there.
Paula, so, I now see why you have written 18 books. This is
and it changes every year. The latest one is the stem cell thing. I mean, the claims are all over the place, but they're using some stem cell from an apple, a special Swiss apple tree that they're sticking in skincare products and say they have evidence that it stimulates stem cells. So my joke about it has been is that if it's an apple stem cells make apples. If you put that on your skin, are you going to turn into an apple tree? Is it, are you going to have like branches growing out of your face?
Are we honestly that susceptible to sciencey sounding words? Like that's all you need.
Yeah, we are. And the language on the ad sounds so good. And on the infomercials, they're so enthusiastic and they're wearing white lab coats and people are cheering. Oh, and of course, there happen to be thousands of product lines all doing this. My big question is, how does any woman choose which one to get sucked into? So, yeah, I know. I earn a living.
You know, I think that men might want to read these books, though, too, because especially now there's so much more manscaping that goes on, and men are a lot more into the products as well. And I know that when I watch TV, some of the words that they come up with, I need to make a list to see how they actually create them.
I had no idea that hypoallergenic actually meant absolutely nothing. I thought that was a real medical word.
Yeah, well, it sounds very real.
It does.
Yeah.
Because it has hypo
and allergenic.
Right. And those two together. Obviously, it does something.
It's funny you can take two words that mean things separately, combine them together, and eliminate that whole problem.
But that's the thing. All of us in this booth are very conscious of trying to be as evidence-based as possible. And that was something that I totally overlooked. It was just one of those things that I automatically assumed. And again, we are hyper-aware, not hypo, hyper-aware. So can you imagine what people who aren't that aware go through? How much money do people spend on stuff like this?
I know people who spend a lot of money.
Yeah. You know, you don't have to go far to see someone that, you know, prefers to buy their specialty product that costs 80% more than everything else and has virtually the same ingredients because they think that the apple tree stem cells are going to do something, but they don't really know what, usually.
This is selling hope, just like every other product like this. So we also talk about some controversial stuff occasionally on the show, some more than others. Here's a bit from an episode we did on nuclear power.
Tritium is one of nature's least radioactive materials. It also gets maligned in the press. Of all the radionuclides that Health Canada regulates by saying how much of this you can have per liter of drinking water, say, the drinking water standard, if you go on the Health Canada website, which is echoed on the Canadian Nuclear Safety Commission website, they list all the radionuclides and they give the number of becquerels, which is the number of disintegrations per second, which is related to the amount that you can have per liter. And for tritium, it's 7,000 becquerels. becquerels per liter. And the other amounts that you would see for other radionuclides are in the range of 10 or 5 or sometimes up to 100. So 7,000 is a large number, which people say, oh my goodness, that's huge. That's massive. How can they allow that? It's the same basis that the other ones use, and the number is large because the biological effect is much less. And that's the end of the story. There's no other reason for it.
I believe Elena had a comment about this.
Yes, the 7,000 becquerel limit here in Canada is actually 10 times what it is in the United States. It's 500 times what it is in California and 70 times the European Union. And that's because of the kind of reactor we have here with the heavy water that lets off more tritium. In fact, there was a recent study in 15 countries.
It's not because we release tritium. I told you where it came from. It's derived by the same limit that all the other radionuclides are derived. There's no difference.
It's a much higher than in any other country.
No.
Well, that is correct. The limits on how much tritium can be let into the environment in California is 500 times less.
No, Elena, with due respect, you listed three or four that it is greater than. You missed the World Health Organization, which is 10,000 becquerels per liter. You missed Australia, which is 80,000. You missed Sweden, which is 70,000. So it's actually in the middle of the world ranges. It doesn't matter because even the highest of these that we've listed in the last little while, these countries, is still way below what's dangerous. We're talking hundreds of times less than what's dangerous. So it's like saying, why is the age of drinking different in Alberta than it is in Ontario? Why is the age of driving different in the United States? Why is it 21?
I told you so. As soon as we start talking about safety, we don't talk about anything else.
So that entire episode went kind of like that.
Really?
And they were both in the booth with me. So that was occasionally uncomfortable.
Yeah, I can see that, yeah. I'd like to give a shout out to tritium there. We were talking about how tritium gets a bad rap. But yes, there was a little bit of friction there. It was almost fissionable.
Oh. I have some reservations about nuclear power, but I thought that episode, that guy is kind of my hero because he was prepared. And every time she came up with a claim that was not factual, he had all the information around. He just said, nope, this is where you're wrong, this is where you're wrong, this is where you're wrong. And I was really impressed by that. I thought that was amazing.
Well, this is the thing. I've changed my opinions about nuclear power because of the research that I specifically did for that episode. I talked to Mike years ago, and I was violently opposed to it. Now I'm only violently opposed to certain bits of it, and really, it comes down to doing more research. So, here's another kind of awkward, really. This is John Logsdon from the Sex, Genes, and Evolution episode. We have a question from the website.
What is the weirdest form of reproduction that you've encountered?
And it also states, I'm really hoping he talks about bat bugs.
So I knew a little bit about bat bugs, and bat bugs are relatives of bed bugs. And I looked up a little bit paper on bat bugs. And what they do is they have what's called traumatic insemination. Sounds traumatic. Mm-hmm. instead of having... For the females, instead of having a vagina, let's say, you know, a receptive part of her body, the male just stabs his penis into the body. They have a hemocele, which is the sort of circulatory system, and stabs the body and inseminates the body, and then the sperm makes it to the reproductive tract. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, it sounds awful, doesn't it? And so bed bugs are known for this, and it turns out bat bugs are also known for this. And there's some really interesting stuff that has evolved what we call conflicts, right? So what happens is, you know, if in a species the male is doing this traumatic insemination, that might lead to a countermeasure on the female's part to come up with, you know, something that would ameliorate to make that not so bad, yeah.
Yeah.
And so there's lots of interesting sort of what we call arms races between the males and the females. And for the bat bugs, you know, they've evolved. They can't even tell whether they're males or females when they start because they have appendages that don't distinguish them because they're issues of trying to sort of battle this phenomenon. So there's that's not even the weirdest thing out there. But bed bugs and bat bugs are pretty cool.
Okay.
I think the weirdest thing is, my favorite are these organisms called spoonworms. And these are invertebrate animals. And the male is relegated to essentially what evolutionarily a male is usually relegated to, unless you're talking about a social organism, which is making sperm. And it turns out the male is something like 10,000 times smaller than the female and degenerates and basically attaches near her genital opening and basically is attached there for life only making sperm for his entire existence. So that to me is sort of the most unusual and interesting and sort of illustrates the idea of, well, what are males good for? Well, you guess.
Oh, you know, today I wish we had video because everybody in the studio right now has an absolutely horrified expression on their face.
You realize I get credit for saying this as a man.
Oh, my. Okay.
See, the bat bug story, as weird as it is, I feel like it kind of gives me some hope because you figure no matter how bad your last date was, at least you weren't getting stabbed in the carapace. You know what I mean?
My admiration goes out to bat bugs. I mean, they were really the first sexual pioneers. Really opened up a lot of doors for other vertebrates, invertebrates, and other brates.
I'm just glad I don't believe in reincarnation.
Yeah.
I don't actually have any comment for this. Besides, science is gross. Honestly. Let's stick with the theme here. This is Vanessa Woods, author of Bonobo Handshake.
Now, you brought up sex. So now we're going to talk about this. First of all, the title of the book is Bonobo Handshake. So what does that refer to?
Well, it's really funny because my publishers decide to put a picture of me and a bonobo shaking hands on the cover of my book. But that is actually not what a bonobo handshake is.
No, I found that rather amusing, really.
No, I know. I'm like, did you even read the book, you publishing people? So it turns out that a bonobo handshake is when two females rub their clitorises together and we think they orgasm. They look like they're orgasming. So, you know, in the kind of the primatology world, this is what a bonobo handshake is.
They're a friendly bunch.
Do you want to ask me about their clitoris? Because I saw stuff on Twitter going earlier today. I think you want to ask me about their clitorises, so go ahead.
But you already brought them up. You know what? The way you describe them in the book, actually, there were a number of points in the book that I actually blushed. I felt like I was reading softcorn porn. They're very human, my friend.
I didn't even put the worst stuff in there. The worst stuff I saw, like, you know, like less than a year ago, and that didn't get to go in the book. Okay, but yes, the bonobo clitorises, they are extraordinary. They are long, they're pink, and I mean, they can curl around an iron bar. I mean, this is how...
This is what I'm talking about.
Yeah, seriously. I mean, and even the baby females, you know, they're kind of like this little, like they rub them up against you because as humans, we are the ones with the hang-ups. I mean, and the other reason why I called it the book Bonobo Handshake was because for bonobos, sex just isn't a big deal. It's kind of like a handshake. It's like a, hi, how are you? I'm okay, you're okay. Let's rub our clitorises together and that will make us feel nice and socially facilitate whatever event this is.
That's what I found so interesting is the fact that you talk about the matriarchy and you talk about the females correcting the males, but it's also they control the situation through sex.
Yes, and that is the big thing about bonobos, but I would just like to say that I think the reason why bonobos have been, one of the reasons why they've been ignored for so long is just that their sex is so outrageous and people can't seem to move past that. But the most important thing about bonobos and the thing that they really can teach us is that they live in a society without violence. So just like bonobo cooperation, we can learn from bonobo cooperation. You know, I live in a pretty small town, like, you know, close to somewhere called Durham. And last week up the road, someone got shot, you know, where I go to get my clinical visits. And then something like 20 people a year are murdered here. And I'm sure, you know, in the U.S., there's over 1,000 murders a year. And, you know, going beyond the U.S., in Congo, like I said, the death toll is up to 5.4 million. Like 1,500 people die a day over there. And, you know, and the rest of the world, the Upsala conflict database says that there's 7 wars going on right now that kill over 1,000 people a year. And so, you know, conflict and violence and murder is a really huge part of who we are. And when I wake up in the morning, I know that there's a chance that someone might kill me. Like, without question, someone might kill me. And when a chimpanzee wakes up in the morning, they have exactly the same thought, you know? And as a matter of fact, if you're a male chimpanzee, you are more likely to be killed by another male, a male chimpanzee, than by anything else. And so I would give up all this stuff that we have just to wake up as a bonobo, because they don't have that. And that's the most intelligent thing about them, and that is why I always say that they're the most intelligent ape.
Okay, now I'm really caught after that clip between wanting to talk about long, pink, iron-gripping clitorises and the absence of war. So I feel awkward again.
Yeah, I mean, and it raises an interesting point. If evolution is real, why are monkeys millions of years ahead of us? Also, I wish I had a single limb that could curl around an iron bar. That'd be great. That's on my wish list.
And now I wish I believed in reincarnation.
Okay, and I would like to point out that Ryan really, really wanted to participate in this episode, and the poor guy has basically lost his voice. So I'm sure you're thinking very, very funny things right now. He's nodding. So sex isn't the only way to get people interested in science. You know, it helps, definitely. But there are other ways. But first, here's the young Australian skeptics telling us how not to do it.
I do want to get to what I said at the start of the show. How can we create more of you guys? And there was a lot of talk about cloning and stem cell research in the chat room, and that's not exactly what I'm talking about. What can science and skepticism do to make more young people want to be involved?
I'm going to tell you right now, if you want to reach the young people, the people who are maybe my age or slightly younger, please don't use rap music because young people don't really like rap music that much. Just speaking as an average 18-year-old.
Elliot does.
He's not an average person. No, it's fine. Some people do, but the majority of people, I'm sorry. A lot of people don't, and it's not, they see it as a blatant attempt to sort of reach out to young people, but they just laugh it off. They know they're not actually being engaged by it.
I disagree with you.
Switch off.
Because I think if you do it in a smart way that's not like lame, like if you had Steve Novella like doing a rap about
oh, come on, that would be awesome. That would be awesome.
I would find that really lame, but someone like Graydon.
No, you wouldn't. You'd find it awesome.
I don't think I would. Someone like Graydon Square, who's an amazing rapper. Like, he's really good. He talks about skepticism and atheism in his music, and he's fantastic. And I think that's a perfect way to get to people.
I know. I agree that there are people who do it well, but the problem is that the young people who don't like that sort of music aren't going to listen to it. They're not going to go, oh, I'll listen to it and see if it's good rap. Even though I don't really like rap, I'll see if it's good. And then I'll make up my mind. They're going to sort of just turn off as soon as they hear it. It's not the way to reach people, I don't think.
What do we start our show with again, though?
Yeah.
It's pretty darn good.
Oh, is that? Yeah. Wait.
Just because we get advice doesn't mean we have to take it.
And, you know, I do think he's right, though. If somebody doesn't like rap, that's not going to encourage them to get into skepticism. But if they already like rap and they happen to be listening to a rap song that happens to have some science in it, you know, they might like the song enough to go check that out.
Or if you're already interested in that sort of thing, because I like Graydon Squared and various skeptical rappers, I suppose, for lack of a better word. So,
side note, we should really, like, this is a really good point, and, you know, we should learn from this and really embrace activities that kids today identify with, like roller skating and
too busy huffing
hayrides?
Stuff.
Hayrides? I think they still love hayrides.
And here's someone else who disagrees with the young Australian skeptics entirely, rapper Baba Brinkman.
We have a chat room question, actually.
This is from Dr. Lannis. He asks, what are the best rhymes for phenotypical and eukaryote?
Well, I haven't actually written any, but I could be like, if you don't believe that I'm a good rapper, then don't be so cynical, because you can listen to the way that I express it when I'm phenotypical.
Okay.
Wait, what was the second one again?
Eukaryote.
Okay. Learn as much as you can about creationism and then do what you can personally. You bury it because it needs to be suppressed like a digested eukaryote. That right there is a new rhyme. That's freestyle. That was a new variant.
Beautiful.
I don't care what anybody says. That was awesome. For real.
He's actually the first person in history to rhyme with the word eukaryote.
I would not doubt that at all. And actually, he'll be on the show again in a few weeks to talk about his new album, The Rap God to Human Nature. Okay, so here's someone that definitely knows how to make science accessible to everyone. Daniel Loxton of Junior Skeptic Magazine.
I know it was before your time, but do you know why Junior Skeptic started in the first place?
Not too far before my time. Junior Skeptic, some of your listeners may know a great thinker by the name of Lisa Simpson. She was a fan of a fictional magazine called Junior Skeptic, which is based on, it's a little nod to, the Real Skeptic magazine. So in a little bit of a recursive circle. Junior Skeptic is based on the fictional Junior Skeptic, which is based on the real skeptic.
Which is brilliant. Well, so you mainly examine paranormal claims and monsters and such in Junior Skeptic. Why is that?
That's right. You know, we try to teach science and critical thinking or promote a scientific worldview, promote curiosity and interest in the world. To do that, we use the paranormal as a kind of a hook. Everybody likes a monster. Everybody likes a mystery. Figuring out how you get to the bottom of those things is sort of a soft sell for figuring out how you get to the bottom of anything. How do you learn anything about the world? Things have to be investigated. Evidence has to be found and hypotheses have to be weighed. You know, the same techniques apply, the same lessons apply.
And do you think that the monsters and such are just more accessible to youth?
Well, I think they're more accessible to everybody. I love monsters. And, you know, one of the things we hear very often at Skeptic is people will write to us or will contact me and say, oh, you know, I actually read Junior Skeptic. Adults will say this. And I always say, well, I don't know why you're looking so sheepish about it. That's true for most of our readers. Most of our adult academic readers read Junior Skeptic, and they do it first. They turn to it as kind of like turning to the comic section of the newspaper. And, you know, when I was just a reader of Skeptic magazine, I would turn to Junior Skeptic first. It's
because it's helpful. Comics.
Yeah, it's
everybody turns to the comics
monsters
first.
Yeah, you go comics, forum letters,
exactly,
book reviews, and you get to the features last. That's the natural progression.
So, would you say the Junior Skeptic is a bit of a gateway drug?
Well, we aim it to be a gateway into wonder and awe for the majesty of the universe.
That sounds better.
Actually, I buy that just for Junior Skeptic.
Really?
That's pretty much it.
It is the best part. I have to say, you know, no slight on Skeptic magazine. Fantastic magazine. But that is the best part.
I like the pictures.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we set the table for Jeff Potter, author of Cooking for Geeks, Real Science, Great Hacks, and Good Food. From overclocking your kitchen appliances to recipes right out of a chemistry lab manual, we'll explore how delicious cooking can be when you add a dash of tech and a pinch of inventiveness. And on Speaking Up, immunologist Dr. Gary Stadmauer joins us to explain the science behind food allergies. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, Friday night at 6 Mountain Time, live at skepticallyspeaking.com.
So another way to explain science to lay people is through humor, but that sometimes has drawbacks. Here's science comedian Brian Mallow.
Let's go back to when scientists should maybe not be as funny. You said Stephen Hawking is happy to be funny, which is good. But is there any time that maybe some of their lame jokes make you wish they'd stick to science?
No, I don't know. I do think that sometimes people are a little skeptical. They're wondering when they hear science comedian, I think sometimes they have this association that they've seen people that are scientists trying to be funny and they thought it wasn't funny. But I'm actually coming at it as a comedian first who just happens to love science. You know what I get asked a lot is when I say that I perform to scientists, then they go, well, do scientists have a sense of humor? And what I found is that, yes, they do, but sometimes they're very literal-minded, and that's something that, and in a way, you know, maybe I deserve this because it's the way I've always been. And for instance, I was doing a show, and I was talking about the heat in Arizona and about how it was 110 in Tucson, 125 at Lake Havasu. And I said, that just sounds like the surface of Venus. And from the back of the room, someone went, no.
Oh.
Venus is much hotter than that. And you know what? Honestly, I was aware of that. But I was using a comedic device called exaggeration.
Oh, it's not as funny when you have to explain.
Yeah, but I mean, so in that way, sometimes they're like, I have to be funny, of course, but unlike a lot of comedians, I'm being forced to be literally accurate, scientifically accurate. Sometimes, here's a great response. What comedians want from an audience is laughter first. We like applause, but laughter, then applause.
Right.
What I've had to decide is a great response and just accept it, is sometimes I tell a joke and I'll see someone in the front and they're thinking, and then they're nodding their head. It's like they're going, they have found that the joke is sound. And they're not, they're like, yes, okay, I find no flaw in that joke. Oh. You may carry on, comedian.
That's beautiful.
And
that
I have
beautiful.
To take that as a compliment and go, okay, you know, he didn't actually laugh, but he found no flaw in the joke.
Anyone?
I don't know what kind of comedian can't make, you know, ends meet out of the comedic gold mine that is the surface temperature of Venus. And there's so much possibility there. I mean, right offhand, well, is anyone else?
I think a lot of scientists just laugh on the inside.
Really?
Yeah. They could be laughing on the inside.
No, I'm not doubting that they're laughing on the inside, but why can't they laugh on the outside?
I could, as a comedian, I could see that being kind of a downer. If they're all laughing on the inside, it sort of doesn't leave anything for you on stage.
Well, it's not your ideal
very
audience,
quiet theater.
For sure. No.
Okay, now let's talk about the topic of interesting things that humans believe, because that comes up a lot on this show. But have you ever wondered how widespread those beliefs actually are? Maybe in Australia, perhaps? Martin Bridgestock and Kylie Sturgis can tell you.
So overall, would you say that the results of the study were what you were expecting?
I was expecting to find a massive belief in creationism in Queensland, and a well above average belief in other aspects of the paranormal. I'm not finding that. I was really quite startled. It shows how a small, politically dominant group can distort the image of a state. Queensland's general outlook is very similar to that of other Australian states, and I dare say, to both Canada and the United States. That really surprised me. It also delighted me, I hasten to add.
Kylie?
Yes, absolutely, because even though I'm on the other side of the country as a person growing up in the 1980s, I'm afraid Queensland was a bit of a laughing stock.
Yes.
And we sorry, Martin. And
it's all right.
You should have immigrated over here, heaven's sakes, anyway. And there were even television programs, continual news broadcasts about what was happening in the state of Queensland and how bad the political situation was. And so to discover those results was just as surprising as it was to Martin, I suspect. One of the things that did get to me was finding the element of education. In a way, it sort of says to me, in order to challenge and question pseudoscientific and paranormal beliefs, it's a matter of use it or lose it. You have to hopefully continue on educating people in order to have people reflect upon and perhaps change their mind on these things. And I guess that's something for future studies as well.
You know, there is some fascinating research out there, hey? You know, I really love to test my gut reaction against what science actually shows, because I'm often wrong. We're all often wrong, actually.
I do the same thing, but I find it disappointing when I'm wrong. It's always better the other way.
There's no value to finding out the truth.
I was just much happier thinking I was smarter than everybody else. And that's kind of the principle I operate under. And I'd like to point out that, like, being an actual expert in any given subject, I think, would just get in the way of my casual expertise in pretty much everything. And that's why don't go to school. That was my message, everyone.
I'm going to go somewhere with this. This is going to be my segue. Some people are abrasive. And our next clip is about another abrasive person.
I remembered an incident that occurred that I'm going to offend some people here, but I think it's worth saying, and I won't use any real names. But I was asked to go to a famous museum about a year ago and stand around with five or six other scientists and look at the exhibit that they were putting up prior to its, you know, a week before it was going up, and they had all the text in draft form to make comments about the text, to make comments about the objects being displayed and so on. And some of the people there knew a lot about the museum and what was in the museum. And I found it very interesting that there were five or six academics, and it was a different environment to be in. And everybody seemed to be most interested in making sure that everyone else knew that they knew interesting esoteric facts that would never, ever get on this exhibit. This thing's about, you know, mm-hmm. if you put this particular species up in this picture, somebody might come along and realize that the sample you have in the case is actually a subspecies that's a different one from the other side of Australia. You know, and we're talking about a sponge or something. and then, of course, they would all say, well, but it doesn't matter for the exhibit, okay?
That's interesting.
I got to say, journalists are often very guilty of just taking the most interesting but also sometimes the most unimportant information from scientific studies, from scientists, when doing a story that involves science, and just using that because it's interesting, because they can use it in their lead.
Well, yeah, and I think that the experience I had resonates with what you're saying, in the sense that if you're trying to get the basic story from the scientists. You know, and the exhibit designer was an experienced person who's done a lot of exhibits with a lot of scientists, and he was very patient, and he was expecting what he got. And it was useful. A lot of errors were corrected, and useful stuff happened. But most, and I remember it especially because I only had a half an hour I had to go. And I remember thinking, stop talking about the esoteric crap you know.
Right.
And answer the question, is this label erroneous or not? And I think that a lot of science conversation among scientists is justifiably like that. That's how we talk, because there's a great deal of skepticism within science, and it's an operative, functional part of the fabric of doing science. Is someone tells you something and you just, the first thing you do is you don't believe them. That's what you do first. And then you talk to them like you don't believe them. And when that spills out into talking to the public, that's not how people talk. And I'm not saying we should make stuff up or expound beliefs, but you have to recognize the fact that people do communicate in their day-to-day lives a certain way, and you can't just show up with a whole different way of communication and expect people to relate to that unless you're talking to science geeks. You know, we can talk to science geeks like we talk to each other, and science geeks love that, but there's not that many science geeks.
And that clip was Greg Layden and Omar Mualim, and that was from the Getting Noticed episode. Now, Greg is, of course, the wonderful gentleman that I interview for the reoccurring Everything You Know Is Sort of Wrong segment. And Omar is also known as A-OK, the musician who wrote our fantastic theme song. And I just checked his website, and it looks like he has a new book and album coming out. So if you have money left over after donating to FunDrive, maybe head to assaultofknowledge.com and you can pick those up. And our next clip features someone that we all know and love, someone who is passionate about communicating science, Adam Savage of TV's Mythbusters.
I really want to make sure I get to this question because it was very cute. It was sent in. It was very misspelled. I'm a 14-year-old girl, and I want to be as good at building robots as Grant is on the show. What should I do?
The first recipe for being good at anything is to get obsessed with it. Someone told me this a long time ago. She worked at a gallery in New York with painters, sculptors, illustrators. She said, everybody who makes a living making art, which is one of the hardest possible ways to make a living, you know, and they all come from different walks of life and different backgrounds, different makeups, different psychological profiles. But the thing that unites them all is that they're obsessed with what they do, and they're obsessed with everybody else that's doing it, too. The more you read about a subject, the more you dive into it, the more you start to tease out the important bit. You know, Grant, I think, would be the first one to tell you that 95% of his robot building is problems solved stemming from maybe four or five root principles that are quite simple. And that last 5% is where things get really interesting and where the problem solving becomes really fascinating.
Right.
And watching how other people solve those problems, taking apart lots and lots and lots of stuff. I mean, I took apart so many things. I would buy things at garage sales just to take them apart. And you do that enough, you start to realize how they go back together. And there's no better way to learn how things work. Jamie and I once had a lovely afternoon in the shop. We were doing a stunt, and I had dunked one of his winches in the water, and he had gotten a little pissed off, and I was like, don't get pissed off, I'll clean it out, don't worry about it. So the next morning I showed up, and he had to be this bucket with the winch in it, and I took it out and started taking it apart to clean it and re-grease it and repack it and stuff. And I was looking at it, and he saw me looking at it, and he said, yeah. And I said, this is interesting. And he said, yeah, take a look inside there and tell me how you think it works. And I was like, oh, yeah, because it's not as simple as I thought. And I was taking a careful look. And in the end, I stared at it for about half an hour before I realized what the mechanism was. And he asked me if I wanted hints. And I was like, nope, I don't want hints. And I stared at it. And finally, I got it right. I figured it out. And, I mean, there are a few better feelings than being able to understand the innovations that someone has brought to bear on a specific problem.
Well, 14-year-old girl, I hope that helped.
Skeptically Speaking accepts no responsibility for children who may decide to dismantle their parents' appliances and not put them back together.
That's what he said. And really, that's our time, everyone. Thank you, everyone in the booth, for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, everybody.
And thank you, Mark Julian, who is currently taking live action shots of us.
And miming.
I suppose they're dead action shots.
Anywho, I hope everyone enjoyed their trip in the Wayback Machine. Dork. Thanks so much to everyone who donated and to everyone who posted on Facebook and Twitter about donating and everyone who's listening to this via podcast or on one of our rebroadcasting stations and is now going to donate online.
right now. And thank you, of course, for listening. We'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
We do have one question from the website.
I heard that commercial jetpacks are finally becoming available at a cost of $86,000 and a year-long wait. Given that the price will come down at some point, do you see personal flight coming close to the ubiquity of personal automobiles?
I don't think that's a real word.
Ubiquity? I'm going to be using that in an article tomorrow, and then my editor will knock it off on Monday. Okay, two things. One, the $86,000 jetpack is not a jetpack. It uses propellers, so by definition, it's not a jetpack. Because a jetpack would have to use air and turbines and things of that nature, and this thing does not use that. However, it does let you frickin' fly in the air. So I'll drop the little technical issue there.
All right.
I don't think that the price is ever going to fall down to the level where it's going to be within the average person's means to purchase one of these things as anything other than a curiosity. It's not going to, I mean, the things are enormous. They're not practical. They're not easy to get in and out of. And also, ultimately, governments, I believe, and I hope at any rate, would legislate the heck out of these things because I don't know about you. I don't know what the traffic's like up there. In Atlanta, if there's a piece of cardboard on the road that's going to cause a traffic snarl that goes back dozens of miles, I can't imagine the kind of traffic incidents you would have with people zipping around like Superman all over the city.
I'm not sure if that would happen here. This is, we don't even have mountains, sir. This is prairie country.
Oh, well, then you're fine.
Okay, great.
We have,
I will
we have
accept really my jetpack now.
Yeah, we've got really tall buildings, and all I can imagine is watching someone scrape the third person off my window that morning. It's just, I don't want to deal with that.
Nicely put, sir.
The secret to happiness is to have realistic expectations. And realistic expectations mean that none of your decisions will be perfect, that many things you do, you will adapt to so that the excitement they provide at the beginning will wear off. Your new car will quickly just be your car. The unbelievable passion you have for your romantic partner will just become ordinary passion, and then physical attraction, and then occasional physical attraction, and then sort of thinking about a movie star while you're having sex with her. You know, this is, you can reduce you can minimize this process, you can slow it down. If you're aware that it's going to happen, I think it's not quite so painful when it does happen. It's only if you think, a la Hollywood, that you're going to be starry-eyed every time you look at each other for the next 60 years that you have an opportunity to be disappointed by what actually happens. So we create expectations about how that part of our life is supposed to go, and it doesn't go that way because it can't go that way, and we feel disappointed and also that we failed. So I think people suffer much more from having expectations that are too high than from having expectations that are too low.
So that's what you would leave people with? Lower
your
expectations.
One thing is good enough is good enough, and the second thing is lower your expectations. You think that's depressing?
I vaguely.
It's a recipe for happiness, for God's sakes. It's easier to be happy than we think. You don't need the best to be happy. You just need good enough to be happy. I just took the pressure off you. You don't need to look at 2,000 pairs of jeans anymore.
and for that, we thank you.
My pleasure.
Thanks so much, Barry, for being on Skeptically Speaking.
It really was. You asked fabulous questions. It was a pleasure.
Skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell. Break the spell of Pavlov's bells. Cause we're skeptically speaking. Online reading tarot cards and witches, psychics, and their spoon bending mind tricks. All the humbug, flim flam, frauds and shams, the charlatan who I don't think you understand. It's the hocus pocus, out of focus, locus, eroding the brain, making gains on the hopeless. Let the crystal ball fall, smash on the floor. Leave the pieces alone, we don't need them anymore. Just a microscope, telescope, magnifier, reading in between the lines of these lies. Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is. Cause we're skeptically speaking.
Skeptically Speaking is recorded live at CJSR in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Michael Harrison manages our electronic communications. The soundboard is run by Ryan Bromsgrove. Lisa Skovanek is our assistant studio technician. Post-production editing and additional research by K.O. Myers. Our theme song is written and recorded by A.O.K. And I'm your host, Desiree Schell.